That's like the new Billy Eichner movie, Bros, where there's that line, you know, it's like, we had AIDS and they had glee. And we didn't have glee, so we had the real world, and we could be vampires or hippies or cyborgs, and it was all allegory.
Hello and welcome to Did I Do That? It's a podcast about making graphic design and making mistakes because it's all part of the process. I'm Sean Schumacher, and joining me today, a very special guest. He's the co-founder and creative director of Fuza, a community-centered design consultancy. He also hosts and produces podcasts and podcast-adjacent things for the AAGA, where he currently serves as the director of design, content, and learning. It's Lee Sean Wong. Hi!
Hi, Sean. It's very easy to remember your name. So you can both be Sean.
Yes, we're doing double duty on the Seans, and we're the same spelling too.
Indeed.
This is actually not a comfortable chair. Okay. That's what I'm learning.
Feel free to move to the sofa, I don't know if the rolling chair is really the best either, but there's also the dining chairs we can move.
No, this should be all right. It's just a little odd. It is
odd. I think it's like the killed Grimace and turned him into a chair.
R.I.P. Grimace.
Oh,
he just wanted that shamrock shake a little too early.
Really have to blame it on Hamburglar. Not just a thief, but a violent criminal, deeply deranged.
Yeah, stealing hamburgers was just kind of the gateway drug in that universe. This is a very silly show. So we're here in Seattle, Washington. This is part of the AIGA National Conference, which is happening like next door. And it's, you know, I'm a big Fraser fan. I don't know if you are also fond of the Fraser program.
My husband introduced me to it recently, but I did not actually watch it in the 90s.
Oh, so this is, you haven't been checking into it in prep for your visit out here.
I have not.
No. Oh, well, from where I am sitting right now, we're in your hotel room. It basically looks like I am in Fraser's apartment right now. It's very fancy. There's the full skyline out there, although there's a lot more construction cranes than I remember in the Fraser program. I believe Fraser was the only crane really depicted primarily. Well, no, that's not true. There were several other members of that family. But yeah, in a lot of ways, this is a nicer place than Fraser's apartment. For one, there's no bad old chair or angry dad or dog that is sort of passive aggressive towards you.
And like Fraser, I've spun out of Boston.
Yeah, you did a couple seasons in Boston.
I've done my time in Boston. Now I live in Providence, so I guess it's still kind of within commuting range of Boston.
I mean, Rhode Island is so very, very small. It may as well have been absorbed into one of the adjacent spaces.
Yeah, but that's the whole thing, right? Because it was started by the folks who were like, okay, Puritans, let's like tone it down just a little bit and just be like a little bit less fundamentalist for a bit. Let's start our own state.
The
50
Puritans
miles away.
Are not going to be into that. They love puritanical things. It's in the name. Yeah, so you've sort of bopped around between a couple different locations on the East Coast, New York and all that.
Well, I'm originally from Taiwan, and then my parents went to grad school in Phoenix, Arizona. So I grew up in the Phoenix area, and then I went to Harvard. So that's my first stint in just outside of Boston.
Your Cheers years.
Yeah. I'm just going to start by dropping the H-bomb instead of like talking around it. It's like, oh yeah, I went to school in Boston. Oh, just outside of Boston.
Just outside
across the river, actually.
It's a big school. I don't know if you'd know it.
So yeah, I did that. And then I lived in Japan for 3 years after undergrad.
Wow.
And then moved to New York and was in New York for most of my adult life until COVID, and then moved out of the city to Long Island, Eastern Long Island, to escape the plague and hang out with deer and turkeys and a dog. And then when things reopened, moved to Boston, where my husband is doing his studies up at MIT.
Oh, wow. So you've kind of, as a marriage, got some very fancy Boston schools in the mix.
Yeah, and he's also a Harvard man. So he's Harvard and MIT. I'm only Harvard and NYU. So.
It's its own sort of prestige.
Yeah.
You're in the city, you know.
In the city.
I don't know where NYU is in the city, but it's somewhere there.
It's like in Greenwich Village, but it's also in Brooklyn now. It's really everywhere. I mean, they would take over everywhere if they could.
Yeah, universities have a way of infesting their neighborhoods and, you know, slowly creeping out.
It's a real branding problem as a designer, because they're also like in Abu Dhabi. That was their first big spin-out
campus. There's a lot of schools doing that now. Yeah.
And so you like have the New York brand, but then it's also in Abu Dhabi. It's like, I don't know. I mean, it's like not my problem as a brand system.
Yeah, I feel like it is more of a problem when your school is named after a specific location. It's hard to make the argument that New York University Abu Dhabi branch makes a lot of sense, being right. that they are two fundamentally different locations.
Right. It's different from like Parsons Paris and Parsons New York, where it's like it's a name, but it's not like named after the city.
Parsons could be anywhere. It lives in our hearts primarily.
Right.
And in parsonages, which is, I think, where monks live. I could be wrong about that. Don't write in if you know, because I will have forgotten that I said it. It is an interesting problem. So you grew up primarily in Arizona. Like, what sort of turned you onto design initially?
I would say print shop and dot matrix printers, which is also a way of dating myself.
Did you have like an Apple II?
My parents owned a computer store, actually.
Oh, wow.
But they were like a sort of PC clone kind of store, whereas mostly like B2B. So they sold to like companies and to like school systems and government offices and stuff like that. But there was a storefront. Yeah, we didn't really convert to Mac until my parents retired, and then they all got Macs and iPhones. And like, obviously, I work in design, so I'm also like, you know, indentured to Apple now. But I grew up with these sort of like DIY PC clones, where it's like, oh, if you wanted a computer, you could have whatever you wanted, but you had to go to the warehouse and like put it together yourself.
Oh, wow. But I mean, I bet you get a lot of extra horsepower out of one of those.
We always had the latest things. Or actually, our very first computer before my parents started the store was a Commodore 64, where you plugged it into your TV.
That was such a special time in computing, when we just didn't think the way that things displayed was very important.
Yeah.
My very first computer was a Commodore Amiga, which I think was like essentially the generation after that.
There was one Amiga in my school's computer lab, and it was like the special computer that had like a color monitor.
Oh, yeah.
That wasn't just like green and black. And I just remember like there was all sorts of like demos on that. And there was like the equivalent of Photoshop. I don't even remember the name of the software, but they had like a demo image that was like a pharaoh, like a Egyptian pharaoh. And it was just like, wow. The colors are like so vibrant and realistic.
Yeah, and that was the whole big thing with the Amiga, is like at least early digital broadcast graphics were almost always sort of a piece of software and a peripheral attached to an Amiga, because the Amiga was like fancy for graphics.
Yeah, they called those like toasters, right? Like
video toaster. Yeah. Oh, toast some video. Don't mind if I do.
Is this podcast really going to, it's going to turn into like old guys talk tech.
That's what the kids love. You know, they love the past and how wacky it was. It's why everything from 1998 is popular again.
Yeah. I was explaining last semester, I was somehow got into some conversation explaining how VHS tapes worked and how you had to like edit with two VHS decks to like, so like to a grad student. So it wasn't even like a kid, right?
Yeah.
It was like somebody in their 20s or like early mid 20s who's like a photo and video guy. And he was just like shocked. I was like, how did you guys make anything?
Well, yeah, it's kind of astonishing how linear everything used to be. Like before we started recording, I was telling you about like my dad, when he was doing audio production back in the day, he would literally cut and tape together tape.
Right.
Like the fanciest stuff was that.
And it's effort too, because it's you had to make a mixtape for someone. You had to like listen to the radio, make sure that the DJ didn't talk over the intro of the song.
Good luck
with
that.
Hit record, right, and put that together. And I guess it's still an act of love to like burn them a CD or something like that. Like that's still some effort versus like, I made you a playlist on Spotify.
Yeah, that's disappointing. Like the objectness is very special there. Like, you lose that. You lose a lot.
Yeah, and you can like doodle on the little sticker that you put on the cassette tape.
Yeah.
And personalize it that way.
I guess you could put a lot of love into like the printed out card with the QR code on it that you give to the person you want to go out with. Here, there's a little heart in the middle. I hope that didn't affect... Oh, it did. Okay, so now you can't scan it. Whoops. Well, the message is what counts. It's funny how much things change. So where were you using like PrintShop Pro and all that?
I guess at home and at school. I think there was something just really great about like the sound of it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
We would like... I think that's something I miss about those dot matrix printers, because it had like, you know, all the sheets of paper were connected with the kind of perforations.
Yes.
So you could just like print out like big old banners and then stick them on the wall.
Oh, the banners. That was the big selling feature of PrintShop Pro, wasn't it?
The yeah. It's banner like, oh, the making. Happy birthday banners. Or you could just like make anything, right? Like, welcome home, Dad. Dad went on a business trip or something. It was just like things like that.
Yeah.
Which is... I don't think we have an equivalent to that.
No. Anymore. Like, right. You'd have to go to Fast Signs, and I'm sure they'd charge you $90 or something.
Right. Or, like, it's not the same to just, like, tape sheets of 8.5 by 11 together. There's a speaker at this conference, Libby Rose Striegel from the first day, who I got to introduce and then interview. And she runs this, like, museum, basically, at the University of Colorado Boulder, which is like full of obsolete tech.
Ooh.
So they have like, you know, the one laptop per child and Apple IIe's and all sorts of things. And it's unique because it's open to people. Like you can actually like play with the computers and touch them and do stuff rather than just like seeing them in display cases. Like I saw at the Design Museum when I was in London last month. Which it's still surreal to see your childhood like objects a museum.
Oof.
But anyway, like Libby's... What I was talking to Libby about in our Q&A afterwards was like not just the obsolete hardware and software, but these behaviors that have become like obsolete or retro, or even sounds, right?
Yeah.
Like the sound of a modem or the sound of a dot matrix printer, and these things that are just kind of like endangered in our 2022 world.
Yes, I think maybe it was Libby, but I seem to remember there was some sort of institution that was trying to collect, you know, examples of those sounds to preserve them, because especially like a modem, like I'll never be able to dial into AOL again.
It felt like our family really made it in the world. Like it was like, oh, we got a second line. So, you know, if you were like logged in, you know, using the modem to get onto like Prodigy or America Online,
yeah,
you know, like somebody could actually like receive a call or receive a fax.
Did you get online pretty early, considering you had all that hardware
We got online pretty early. Like my parents, because they were, you know, small business owners working hard all the time, like we had a babysitter, so we weren't like totally like, you know, latchkey kids or anything like that, but it was pretty like hands off of like, here are some books and here's some technology and like, you know, don't kill yourselves. And like I did well in school, so it was like pretty like hands off.
That can be a gift and a curse,
yeah.
both at once. When was that? And what was your first service that you were on? Was it like AOL? Or?
It must have been like early 90s. I think it might have been Prodigy. And then I think we were on CompuServe for a hot minute, but that one wasn't super user friendly.
No.
And then AOL, I think that was like, it was like the ascendancy of AOL, and it was like, ooh, like a user interface.
Yeah. AOL really took over for a minute. Like, it's so hard to forget, like, when AOL keywords were the thing that everyone had in their ads.
And they mailed out those installation disks, right?
And yeah.
They were basically, like, giving away the installation disks, and then it's like, okay.
500 free hours? How can I say no?
Yeah, why not? And then there's that, like, triangle logo.
Yeah.
Which, like, all sorts of like conspiracy theories, right? It's like the pyramid on the $1 bill, right? It's like some sort of Masonic plot or whatever it is.
I've not mind heard control. These. There's conspiracy theories about the AOL logo being like some sort of like Illuminati stuff or something.
I feel like suburban Phoenix in the 80s and 90s were kind of a paranoid time and place. I guess
I get
it still
feeling
is.
Current. I think yeah. Phoenix might not be much better.
I got the hell out of there after high school, so. Yeah, there was that. I mean, there was also those urban legends about like people putting drugs in your kids' Halloween candies, which is like also a thing that's still happening today. But I feel like that sort of like satanic panic stuff was happening. That's like the cultural milieu of how I grew up, of like kind of Stepford Wives suburbia, but like with like a tumbleweed, you know, because it's still like at the edge of the desert and then like the digital dimension.
Oh, yeah. And it's so many things fell into that that. Like, I remember being afraid of the idea of Dungeons and Dragons when I was a kid, because that was like the most satanic thing out there. And to think of that today.
Yeah.
Knowing what it is.
That's why it was like such a great like blast to the past with the latest Stranger Things.
Oh, yeah.
Season,
yeah.
Right. I've just had a few friends like come out to me. It's like, oh, yeah, I'm a dungeon master. Like not in the BDSM way, but in the like Dungeons and Dragons way. Where it's like, oh, I got into being a dungeon master during the pandemic. Like, yeah.
I like your framing of it as coming out. It's a core part of their identity.
There's a real like ascendancy of the nerds, I feel like.
True. You
know? I mean, that's the difference, I think, between growing up in the 80s and 90s and clearly being a nerd, where you were still kind of like marginalized.
Yeah, yeah. I was even thinking about like, it had to be like 2006 or something like that, when TV was obsessed with the idea of the nerd. Yeah. Which I think the timing makes sense, because I'm pretty sure that's around when Big Bang Theory started. But like this idea, oh, the nerd is actually great. We actually love the nerd. Yeah. But, you know, like 90% of the time it was about making fun of nerds.
Right, or Goonies, or yeah, like all of those sort of things. Revenge of the Nerds. But I mean, your podcast, ooh, is like clearly an homage to Steve Urkel, right? Like, I do that? Oh, that's Zooey Deschanel doing Steve Urkel. It's like very meta.
I mean, it's essentially a scheme by which I can get many professional designers' takes on a Steve Urkel impression. And then I'll compile them all together and put out a mixtape of them.
Or a TikTok. I think that's what the kids are doing these days.
Oh, I'll be racking up the views with that.
Right.
Kids definitely know who Steve Urkel is.
I can just imagine like the sort of like Chinese agent, you know, at the data farm, like what is happening?
ByteDance executive. Yeah,
what is happening in America?
How do we
weaponize this? Yeah.
Could this be beneficial to us in any way? No. Yeah. Let's just give up. where did you start to get into design kind of more generally? Like,
I was like making stuff with computers.
Yeah.
And also growing up in the 80s and 90s in Phoenix, this is actually one cool thing, despite growing up in a, like a super Republican state, was that there was still the tail end of like a lot of good public investment in education for kids. And so the public university near us, where like my whole family went, they had these programs for kids. And you could go and they would teach you like programming. So we learned like Lego Logo, which was like an early form of basically you could like make animations using code.
Yeah. Was that the little turtle that you would move around?
So Logo was like the turtle that you could move around and draw stuff. And then Lego Logo was like a spin-off of that, where you could also like plug in and do basically what's called physical computing today. So like you could control electronics, like motors and gears and things like that.
I didn't even know that existed back then.
Yeah. It was it was really like ahead of its time.
Yeah.
And so that was like available at the public university for, I don't know, I have no idea how much it cost, but it was like low cost for kids. And then we also, like, as we got older, that same program, which is called CAP, I don't think it exists anymore, it was the Center for Academic Precocity. It was sort of a spinoff for like, it was sort of like the gifted kids program, but it happened on like nights and weekends and over the summer.
Precocity is the goal to get everyone in the program beat up, because that's the only reason that I could think of them choosing that word.
I'm still like in touch online with some like alumni of that program, and we were like, you know, a lot of us ended up in creative industries and we're like relatively well adjusted, or like, you know, our meds work enough that keep everything balanced. But we also learned, there was a class where we got to learn how to use a TV studio, because the university has like the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism. So they had a fully functioning TV studio that they let these junior high kids like run for a few weeks in the summertime.
That's a terrible mistake, but
yeah,
we good opportunity.
Videos. So we, I think this is like seventh or eighth grade summer, we made like a student film called The Surreal World, which was a spoof of The Real World, the MTV show that's now celebrated like 30 years or whatever.
Yeah.
And it was something surreal happened on the set where Rachel Campos, who was like from the San Francisco season, showed up on set, and we had no idea, and she didn't know that we were doing a spoof of the show, but she was like the friend of somebody's older brother who was visiting, and so we interviewed her in character. And the surreal world was like, you know, one roommate was a vampire. One roommate was like a weird hippie person. One roommate was like a cyborg. So these kids, I have the footage somewhere, like digitized.
I would love to see that. Can you give us a little take on your weird hippie character? Can you channel them for me? What was their name?
I don't remember my character's name. I definitely have like a crunchy granola part of myself still. But I just really feel like these vibrations are not doing, it's not really vibing with me. And I feel like my plants are sad.
And half of Seattle just let out a cry.
And we were like 13, 14, you know, we weren't even like stoned or anything.
You have the inherent stoneness of 14-year-olds where everything right. just seems possible, no matter how little sense it makes.
Right. And, you know, not surprisingly, a lot of us turned out to be queer. And, you know, that was a thing. So I think it's like, you know, like hippie or vampire. It was like, you know, this is the early 90s. So, you know, I mean, I guess Anne Rice had already done her thing with Interview with the Vampire. But it was like, you know, you had to use like metaphor and allegory.
Yes.
It's not like Gen Z or younger millennials where they had like Glee, right? That's like the new Billy Eichner movie, Bros, where there's that line, you know, it's like we had AIDS and they had Glee. And we didn't have Glee. So we had the real world and we could be vampires or hippies or cyborgs. And it was all allegory.
That all makes perfect sense, yes. Oh, Jesus. All right. That broke me, and I'm not sure why. So you're messing around at this university campus. Like, what? Where do you go from there?
I was also interested in music. So having the computers at home, I was also making music on computers, like programming like MIDI synthesizers and like making beats and all of that sort of thing. And I also grew up playing like piano and stuff. So kind of fast forward to later. By like college era and post college in my early 20s, I had like various bands and musical projects I was involved in. And that's when I got more into graphic design of like, we have to make our own stickers,
oh,
and flyers, and album covers, and all of those sort of things.
But like, truly, essentially, the utilitarian path where it's like, I want to do this other thing, but if I learn design, then it can serve that need.
Right. Yeah. I don't think design was really like my primary kind of interest at that time. It was more like, okay, I'm into music stuff. I'm into making like weird movies on VHS tapes. And so it's like, okay, if you want like a title sequence, you're going to have to make that, or you're going to have to make your album cover so you can burn some CDs and try to sell those.
I mean, what sort of music were you playing other than, I mean, it sounds like you're playing around with like electronic stuff.
I was doing
stuff.
Some like electronic music. I was also in like a band that was kind of like heavily influenced by like Britpop or Bjork. I mean, the 90s were a great era for music. Now it's turned into like old people talking about music after like old people talking about tech.
Well, we haven't transitioned to old people yelling at cloud, and I think that's where that all falls apart.
And since we're in Seattle, you know, I will also shout out like the whole grunge scene. Like, I was listening to Nirvana and Pearl Jam and Soundgarden and all that sort of stuff back then. So I had pretty eclectic tastes. And so random bands I've been in, like when I lived in Japan, I played in a cover band with these two Japanese girls who did like Ani DeFranco and Cranberries covers.
Oh, really?
And they like, they sang in perfect English. And then they would like afterwards or backstage, they'd be like, oh, yeah, no, English no good. You know, it's like, stop it. And then also played in like a salsa band. In Japan, because there was this Mexican guy who owned a bar in our town where I was an English teacher as my day job in Japan right after college. So I did that for a little bit.
What made you want to do that? Like, that's a big transition.
Yeah, I originally wanted to be like a film major.
Yeah.
I started freshman year at Arizona State, but then I transferred to Harvard. And in Arizona State, you could being a film major really meant like a film studies major, so you could watch movies and like write about them, but there really wasn't much of a production program.
Oh.
But then I was also like just interested in political stuff. And so when I went to Harvard, I ended up being a political science major. I thought, oh, I could maybe be a diplomat or something.
And, be pretty nice work.
Yeah, especially being Taiwanese, Taiwanese-American, but like being from a country that's not really recognized as a country by a lot of other countries and all of that. It's like, oh, could I do something like that?
Yeah.
And so I was also like learning languages, like foreign languages in college and before that. And so I was like, oh, I took Japanese. Why don't I go to Japan and like improve my Japanese? And there was a Japanese government program that's called the JET program, Japan Exchange and Teaching
program. Oh, yes, I've heard of that. Yeah, yeah.
So I applied, but I was actually waitlisted. And since this was early 2000s, by the time I was out of college, I don't know if they even emailed or had our email addresses then, but I had graduated from Harvard. And my parents like came to my graduation, and then we did like a family road trip for like a week around the East Coast before we went back to Arizona. And I didn't have a job. I didn't have anything. And when we got back to my parents' house, there was a message on my parents' answering machine saying, like, if you want to go to Japan, like, call the embassy now because we have a space for you, which is great because, like, I could be employed. And so a few months later, I was on a plane to Tokyo and then to my small town in the south of Japan where I taught English by day and then played music at night and did some freelance writing as well about like Japanese culture and food and stuff like that.
Wow. Had you done any like freelance writing before that, or was that kind of the genesis of that too?
I was like worked on the student paper in junior high, and then in high school, the Arizona Republic, which is like the newspaper of record in Arizona.
That's a big deal.
They had like a teen page. And they would basically like recruit teenagers, like high school kids, to like write articles and like, so I was like a music reviewer for the Arizona Republic, like a teen music reviewer. And they would just like give you CDs or give you concert tickets and you like would pitch them and write for that. So that was kind of cool. So that was also another potential thing. It's like, okay, major in political science and then maybe be like a journalist. There was still like kind of communications or connecting with people in different ways, but I was still kind of figuring it out.
Yeah. I mean, you had a teen dream job, sounds like.
Totally.
Free music and all you gotta do music. Is write about how cool it is.
But this is before like the collapse of journalism as a business model.
Music.
And music and all of those things. I mean, we grew up having the paper, like the actual newspaper every morning.
Yeah, which I, you know, like it's so rare that you even see them around now. So you're in Japan now. Where do you go from there? Like, what's your next step?
So I do the Japan thing for 3 years, which is great. This is around the time that Facebook launches. So
I've heard of it.
Yeah. I didn't know Zuckerberg or any of those guys. They were a couple years younger than me at Harvard. But they launch it like the year after I graduate. So at first it's like only Harvard students and alumni. Yeah. So I was like, my Facebook user number is like in the hundreds. So I'm within the first like couple thousand people who joined Facebook.
And that's wild.
But I was also on like MySpace and all of that sort of stuff. I don't know what the point of this was.
On this show don't have to have a point.
I think it's, just like the social media angle, right? I think it became like another canvas for making stuff. So like learning some CSS so you could like out your MySpace page.
That was a lot of people's entryway into web design as a field. Like I need there to be a horrible song that plays every time you visit your MySpace page.
Right. Or like,
how do I do that?
Yeah. Looking for like weird GIFs and things like that.
Make it as unreadable as possible.
Yeah, there was really like a golden age, the Wild West of social media and the internet, or like GeoCities, right? I feel like there was a real sort of like weirdness to it all
because
folks were still figuring out the medium and it was very experimental, and obviously accessibility did not matter.
No.
And like,
but yet I think a lot of those websites were more accessible than current websites in a lot of ways.
And then there was also like that Flash era, right? Which I learned
a lot of people have passion for that, so I shouldn't say you, but I mean, I started in web design right at the tail end of the Flash era, and a lot of that design era was sort of reacting to how broke, I guess, some of those websites had gotten. Buttons, oh, you don't need to know where those are.
Yeah, just maybe it's helpful to kind of connect the dots on my life and career, and we'll come back to Flash. is basically, so after Japan, I land in New York City because I didn't want to go back to Arizona. And this is 2006, so this is before the financial crisis, actually.
Right,
so there was still a lot of tech money and stuff floating around. I ended up getting a job off of Craigslist, basically doing like campaigns and content for like a nonprofit. And so I worked at a couple different nonprofits in New York City doing like essentially like email marketing stuff and like, you know, graphics for stuff like that, and trying to combine my like political science degree into that.
Yeah.
I worked for like a human rights organization for a year. And then after that, I was like, okay, I don't necessarily want to be a diplomat because I was a little too buttoned up and I was a little too artsy for that. But I liked the comms and the design aspect of that. So I went to NYU for grad school at this interdisciplinary master's program called ITP, the Interactive Telecommunications Program, which was like spun out of the film school back in the late 70s. When video was like the innovation from film. And it's since like been basically about like the recently possible. So when I was there in like 08 to 2010, when I graduated, it was kind of like some creative coding stuff. And I learned Flash, you know, and like after grad school.
ActionScript 3, this will never get old.
And I like, I mean, I knew it enough to actually teach a Flash class at the College of Staten Island for a semester. And now I couldn't like write a line of ActionScript to save my life. Like,
no.
I just have no idea how anybody made anything.
Yeah, it's not like riding a bicycle. You can't just hop right on and make yourself a Homestar Runner cartoon.
Right. Yeah, I mean, looking back, you know, given my background with my parents running the computer store and all of that, I should have just learned like Fortran or something, like Fortran or like COBOL or whatever, and I could have made a fortune. Like, remember during the pandemic when like New Jersey or a few other states were like, oh yeah, we need Fortran and COBOL programmers.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know, those are ancient programming languages. Like,
it's like even before
COBOL's from the 50s, right?
Yeah, I mean, they were literally for programming mainframe computers.
Yes, and so much of our infrastructure in the United States is so out of date. Like, the IRS is still using COBOL extensively.
Right. Or a friend of mine is like was a product manager at Ticketmaster, and I think Ticketmaster only switched over off of those mainframes like a few years ago. It was like a relatively recent thing.
Well, I'm glad that they finally decided to start investing their fees in something beneficial.
Right.
What were they doing with them before? Just throwing them into a Scrooge McDuck vault and swimming around in them?
I mean, I don't think the artists were seeing that.
No. I mean, you know, when you're the ticket master, then you're in charge of the tickets.
Right. So I mean, it was like the 90s, you had the webmaster, and then there was like the ticket master.
Yeah.
And there was like multiple webmasters, right? But only one ticket master.
Oh, I delight in sometimes seeing that on LinkedIn profiles. People who were properly webmasters in the 90s. It's such a weird era.
I was a webmaster well into the 2000s because when I moved back to the States from Japan, I got involved in the Alumni Association for the JET program.
And
it was a pretty like tight alumni community because we're sponsored by the Japanese government, but we're also like our own independent chapters. And we try to foster like cultural understanding between like the US and Japan or whatever country that you attended the JET program from and Japan. But when I first moved to New York, that was like one of the first communities I got involved in with JET, and so they roped me in. Like, they knew I knew some enough web stuff, and it's like, you are webmaster. So I was webmaster for like over a decade.
We are handing you the special sacred blade.
A decade, like way after it was like a thing.
You're kind of getting into the design game in New York. You're bouncing around between different nonprofits. What sort of is your trajectory from there?
When I went back to school, I actually was staying at Human Rights Watch part-time until, like, money dried up. I think Bernie Madoff was one of their big donors or something like that. Or they had I don't know. Like, you know, don't quote me on that one. But a lot of their funders and donors were, like, involved in finance somehow, whether or not directly with Bernie Madoff or, you know, whatever. So there was, like, no longer any funding for my part-time position while I was in school. And I was like, okay, I'm just maybe just focus on being in grad school for a while. Yeah. And then after a while, I was like, okay, I really have to work to live in New York City. And so ended up reconnecting with somebody I'd worked with before, who was starting a creative agency. So my second year of grad school, I landed at an agency called Purpose. They're still around, but they're like owned by a larger conglomerate now, and was like the first designer. I was like the intern, but also the only in-house designer.
Ooh.
In a 5-person company. It was like a 2 IKEA table company at the time. And now they're like legit. They have like a Fifth Avenue office and
all Herman Miller tables and chairs.
Yeah, Aeron chairs. I think we really made it when we had like Aeron chairs. Although it was like in a former Chinatown sweatshop, to be honest.
oh, good.
That was like huge.
Full of great energy.
Huge, but only one bathroom. Worked at Purpose for a while. Actually, it like had some great opportunities there. They were expanding rapidly. Working with nonprofits, but also companies on like social initiatives. So I got to work like in India for like a week, got to go to Germany, all over Europe, helped open up the Brazil office. So wow. I lived in Rio for like 6 months.
Wow. Yeah. Well, that's
learned
pretty good.
Learned some Portuguese, you know, so did some of that.
What was it like going from being the only designer, and I imagine having quite a workload, to like managing people and...
Yeah, I mean, I was more involved in like the recruitment because there was just like trying to hire designers, but also tech people.
Yeah,
And that was like not something I had any background in. I was just like, okay, but I was like kind of a like social butterfly in a way, and also like knew how to post on lists and things like that. So they trusted me with that. And yeah, it was kind of a weird like identity crisis too, because it was an agency run by a lot of ex-McKinsey folks. So it had started out as like strategy and communication strategy, and then like branched out to its own like creative department. So brought on some folks, but like I was like still in school. and so I graduated and they gave me a full-time position, but I also got to learn more about like the strategy side and the dealing with client side. It was so small for the first couple years that like everybody did a little bit of everything. But then I think I was being pulled more and more away from the design and the creative side to be like, oh, do you want to be a middle manager? No. but I'd rather like just make things. And so that's how like FUSA started. That and my now husband, who's my business partner and co-founder at FUSA, was laid off. He was also working in consulting and... he got a job offer to work in fintech, but then that company was literally acquired while he was like loading the U-Haul to move.
Oh,
for
no.
That job. And then it sort of fell through. So he was unemployed unexpectedly. I had a friend who needed me to fill in for his teaching job because he was working on his startup or something. And I was like, okay, I'll take a teaching gig part-time for a semester. That was enough to like pay the basic bills. And then we like started our design studio so we could be more hands-on and not like be middle managers or work for McKinsey people.
I imagine that must be still quite an undertaking, especially unexpectedly, to be starting your own studio.
This is about 2013, I believe. And the real impetus was actually Hurricane Sandy.
That's a problem.
Yeah, it was a problem. We were dating and started this company together, but we weren't living together yet. And my apartment was down in the financial district and the building flooded.
It's
a block and a half from the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel for people who know New York City, but it's the tunnel that connects the bottom of Manhattan to Brooklyn. And what happened was, even though it was like far enough away from the rivers, it filled up with like rainwater and stuff like that. And there was so much water that it backed out and the water came out and flooded a bunch of buildings.
Oh.
And my former apartment building was like a 1920 something building. It used to be the headquarters of a shipping company because it was at the bottom of the island. And it was also like all sorts of grandfathered things that weren't up to code. Like the electrical was in the basement. So all of that flooded. At first they were like, yeah, you're not going home for like 6 months.
Yeah.
And so I was like up in the East Village with my boyfriend and business partner. And then there was like just some surreal stuff. Like there was a conference that I had been asked to attend as part of my position at Purpose, that other agency, that was in Italy. And it was scheduled literally like a week after Hurricane Sandy hit New York City. So I went from like sitting in the East Village with no electricity and no hot water to, the airport still worked. And I was like, I'm not going to stay here. I'm going to Italy. So it's like here at this conference with all of these like urban design people talking about like urban resilience at like, Lago di Como, Lake Como, which is If you're a Star Wars fan, that is where like Anakin and Padme have their wedding, their secret wedding.
Oh.
And they're like sort of we're in love scene. That's Lake Como in Italy, and it's also where like George Clooney has his house.
Wow.
So it's like all sorts of like first world problems, and this like when your life is that surreal for a month, you're like starting your own design studio seems like not a big deal.
No.
Why the hell not? The world is ending, like people want to invite me to Italy to talk about urban design resilience. Like, so I guess I can do things.
I would say that that's a pretty good indicator. You're kind of off to a jump start here with FUSA. Like, I mean, how did you position yourselves early on? Like,
it was really experimental. So my partner doesn't come from a traditional design background either. Hmm. He studied psychology at Harvard and then also studied public policy at NYU. Now he's back at school at MIT doing all sorts of space futurism stuff. He spoke at the AIGA conference as well for professional qualified reasons, not for nepotism. But he's a design futurist systems designer at the MIT Media Lab.
That's so cool.
But he also, like in high school, he worked for like a lawyer. He was like a paralegal in high school and over the summers and for a while. So he actually knew how to like run a small business.
Oh.
Which was super helpful because I went to art school. Like my degree was, at NYU Tisch. and so I didn't know how to do any of that sort of stuff. So he was able to do that as well as some of like the strategy and the client facing stuff. And I was kind of the design generalist in that sense because I had my fingers in all sorts of different things. So we did like some branding work and some like UI UX work for like mostly startups and some nonprofits, things like that. And over the years, we kind of evolved a bit. Both of us were teaching at the Parsons School of Design for a bit. I'm still affiliated with Parsons. And we got involved with designing for city government, like some service design and design research work on like public services in New York. We were invited to do some work in Rwanda as well for the Rwandan government, but also for the genocide memorial there about like museum experience and storytelling kind of stuff. So it got kind of varied, the kinds of stuff we were doing. And then the most recent incarnation before grad school really took my husband away from the day-to-day stuff of the practice and COVID kind of shut everything down. The last few years before that, we were doing a lot of corporate training and facilitation, basically like teaching corporate leaders like design thinking or design-centered methods of creativity. So it's kind of like adult daycare or like kind of some boondoggly stuff, but also some like strategic planning stuff, but like designer as facilitator kind of stuff.
Yeah, trying to help business people think a little bit more creatively and
not just
about rectangles or whatever business people
And spreadsheets and all of that.
Yeah.
And also
numbers. I need the numbers.
Yeah. The ROI and all of that. And that's where like working with the ex-McKinsey people kind of came in handy.
It's God.
Like,
yes.
I can like,
is there a more numbery place?
Yeah. I can
the
do
world.
The sort of like business stuff. I can like communicate in PowerPoint and do all of that sort of stuff. But we also did this kind of work with communities, so that facilitation. In Rwanda, like we got to work with genocide survivors to really like turn their ideas into concepts for like redesigning parts of the museum experience. We worked with the High Line for a project where they have this network of people that they've convened all across North America who want to do like not like copycats of the High Line, but other projects where there's some sort of like old infrastructure that they want to turn into something else. Like there's a LA River project, which
That's a big thing.
Which for folks who don't know, like the LA River is a real thing, but it's like covered, it's been paved in concrete.
Yeah.
And you've seen it in like action movie chase scenes as well as like some like, 90s hip hop videos.
It looks like someone took a gutter and made it really big.
Really big. It's mostly like a trickle for most of the year, but because LA is the desert, like if it rains, it like floods. And
it goes
all the way to the Pacific Ocean. So it's one of those things where it's like, you know, people do stuff down there unofficially, but how can you make that a park, but also get people the hell out of there if it like rains and floods?
Yeah, it's such a hard problem because, I mean, those things can be, I mean, we have that in Vegas too, where I grew up.
Yeah, I think in Arizona, they're called like arroyos, right?
Yes.
Which is like, it sounds like they would like name a lot of these fancy subdivisions for like Arroyo Vista.
I think
was one. And I'm just like, okay, it's like some decorative Spanish, but if you like
flood
no,
hills.
It's actually like floodplain, basically. It's like dry river.
If you live in a place that is named after one of those and the translation is something that is truly ridiculous, please do email me. I know I tell people not to do that, but I would love to hear about that one because I think those would be very, very fun. So how did you get into the podcasting game to begin with?
That was really more like my music background. So I like knew how to do some of this audio stuff.
Yeah.
And editing and mics and all of that. Fusa had a short-lived podcast that was like an interview podcast about creativity, community, and the things that matter. It was called FusaCast, and we just interviewed people and hung out. It was a great way to like network, and meet people, which was fun, but it was just like a lot of work. And then at AIG, I was not actually initially hired to produce podcasts.
Really?
I responded to an AIGA email where they were advertising what was then a part-time position to be the design education manager. I had attended AIGA design educators conferences before. Like I got to go to one in Hawaii back in the day.
Oh.
And I presented a paper there.
Wow.
On some of the branding work I did in Brazil at Purpose. So that was one of my first like AIGA experiences. And so I was on the email list, and basically they were looking for somebody to come in part-time to be like a liaison to other design educators, which was like, okay, I'm doing that. And David had gone back to school at that point, so it's like I could use some extra like regular work and not have to be drumming up like freelance stuff all the time. So like, I'll do that. This is during the time when AIGA had an interim executive director, and so we were like experimenting with a lot of things. Or like, I don't even remember the exact chronology, but I think we were like waiting for some things to happen. And I was like, I have capacity in my like weekly hours. Why don't we just do something else? You know, the other part of my position was to basically be an ambassador for AIGA's Design Futures research, which was published back in 2018. It was research led by Meredith Davis. All of research was done and published by the time they hired me, but they just needed somebody to like get it out there in different forms and make it like less academic-y. And even though I do teach, you know, design, I'm not like an academic in that sense. And so part of the response was to do the first AIGA podcast, which was called Design Future Now, which was like also interview based, but talking about some of these themes of where our profession is headed.
Yeah.
And then COVID happened and they asked me to come on full time to host webinars and produce online content and stuff like that. So now it gets a mix like my design education background with like my content background and take a break from having to live off of client work as my main gig.
It's a big role because, I mean, you also now have in-person events to deal with, too.
Like, yeah.
Like this whole thing, which is huge. I am shocked at how big this is, even.
Yeah, it's so surreal.
Yeah. You know?
And, like, to just even be on a program with, like, Debbie Millman and Brian Collins is, like, so, so surreal.
That's an impressive thing to do. Like, and I think people are hungry for it, you know?
Yeah.
Designers like community.
They like community. It's not just content, right? That's the whole, like, I think content has become so banal, right?
Yeah.
The word, especially that, like, ad-driven big tech talks about it, you know?
Yeah. And there's that side of it, or the, you know, teens doing pranks, which both sides are quite bad.
Yeah. It's like, I mean, content, I guess, is part of my job title, but really it is about, like, connecting with community, whether it's online or now in person again, and the kinds of experiences we have around that content, right?
Yeah. If people want to find your podcasts and your work, where would they go?
I am infinitely Googleable, or Bingable. That's an easier to say word, but nobody uses Bing as a verb. Sorry,
oh,
Microsoft.
They really tried.
Yeah.
They tried so hard.
Yeah.
It's like, and they're right here, too.
Yeah, they're right here. I could be Yahooed, but...
Bill's out the window in the adjacent building looking at us, just crying.
It's like Bing could also sponsor this podcast if they wanted to.
They won't. I think they've given up on Bing.
You can actually just search for me as Lee Sean, like Lee, like Bruce Lee, Sean, like Sean Connery, or Huang, Huang is my last name, and you can find me, although now I have to like update my personal website because that's woefully out of date.
as all designers' yeah. personal websites tend yeah. to be.
Or just look for AIGA Design wherever you get podcasts for our AIGA stuff. We're wrapping up the season, and I think we're going to take the rest of the year off, and we're going to figure out some things and maybe new formats for 2023.
And there's a couple different podcasts that go in that feed.
Yeah.
So you can get a lot of different stuff sort of mixed in. Well, thank you so much for agreeing to be on this very dumb show and taking some time out of your very, very busy schedule at this conference.
Yeah, thank you, Sean. This is like the most fun I've had in a while. Like, obviously, there are a lot of very serious and important conversations we need to have about design, which we had on the main stage. But it's good to just like have some conversations about the lulls as well.
I'm trying to find where the hell I put my stuff that tells me how to wrap up the show. Oh, hey, I found it. If you like this show, why not subscribe to it in the player that you use for podcast playing? There's so many options for that, and this show's on all of them. You can just search for the words, "Did I Do That?" on those. But if you really want to have a good time, may I suggest visiting our website, dididothat.design, which was designed by yours truly and is chock full of wonderful things, including some good images that go along with each and every episode of the show. And, you know, if you want those images delivered less and less frequently to you on various social media services, you can also get to those from that website. This is Did I Do That? I'm Sean Schumacher, and as we always say at the end of every episode,
did I do that?
Thank you so much. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Tremendous. Tremendous. You do a very good Urkel. I'm very satisfied with that. If you want to edit, though, you can do so on the fly by saying the word rutabaga. There's very little chance that we'll talk about rutabagas.
Right. Rutabaga is the safe word.
Yeah. Thank you for phrasing it that way. I'm always reluctant to rutabaga. Do that.
This is a kink-friendly podcast. I have a friend from an acquaintance from grad school who used to work as a professional dominatrix.
Really?
And like one of her clients' safe words was Shaka Khan. Because that just doesn't come up in like casual conversation unless you it's a particular genre of music you're into.
Oh my god, Shaka Khan, that's a really good one. Oh, but then you lose out on all the important Shaka Khan conversations that you can have
right.
during.
And how do you even say Shaka Khan with like a ball gag in your mouth? I have no idea.
Yeah, that doesn't quite work.